You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News. Vice President Mike Pence has long opposed abortion, but he's begun telling audiences that he believes the legal right to an abortion will end in the foreseeable future. "I know in my heart of hearts," he said recently, "this will be the generation that restores life in America." Novelist Lainey Zumas is way ahead of him. She set her novel Red Clocks in an America where abortion providers face the death penalty, where a personhood amendment is about to go into effect, and where a pink wall prevents women who are seeking an abortion in Canada from getting there to obtain one. And many women activists are simply too tired to fight all of it. Lainey Zumas teaches creative writing at Portland State University, and her new novel is titled Red Clocks. And she joins me from Portland, Oregon. Lainey, welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Thanks, Carrie. Glad to be here.
I think that's the thing that I don't want to miss here, that these laws, the personhood amendment, the end of Roe v. Wade, the agreement with Canada, are not happening because Americans are calling for them. They're happening in a way, in a vacuum of organized opposition. And I think your novel shows us how easily something like that might happen.
Yeah, and I think listening to your intro, I mean, one of the things that I'm really hopeful about in our real life current situation today in 2018 is I think there is so much resistance to these attempts to restrict reproductive rights in the United States. And in my book, what I was exploring is kind of at the individual or personal level, what does it mean to slowly wake up to the need to resist, right? And what does it mean for a fairly ordinary person or group of people who aren't paying much attention? At some point, they realize, I need to pay attention. And when I look around at the activism that's happening now in the United States, I'm actually very hopeful about how many of us are paying attention.
You know, see, this is interesting because I would argue that in state capitals, where I think the action really is, that there's a lot of, I mean, there's 63 new restrictions on abortion in various states.
Yeah.
Is it because voters called for that? Is it because voters expressed their views through the representatives to the state capitol that they were voting for? Or is it happening because state lawmakers know that this is something that is most of the time not going to bring on the protests at the Capitol, that they're not going to get a lot of resistance in individual states? What's your thought on that?
Yeah, it's a really important question, I think, because from the research I've done into the sort of personhood movement and the quote unquote pro-life movement, I call it the anti-choice movement in the U.S., I think that at some point, there was a sort of intentional shift to the state level as the focus of getting more restrictions passed because, you know, the strategy was, okay, Roe v. Wade isn't going anywhere at least tomorrow. So what we have to do is kind of take a side route to it. And as you say, in some ways, this has been successful because there are a lot of women in the U.S. right now who live in places where, you know, the nearest clinic where they can get a safe and legal abortion is over 200 miles away.
Right.
They don't have the money or time, you know, to take off work. They might be working two jobs. They can't go and spend 3 days across the state. And so for them, or maybe based on their immigration status, based on a whole host of things, for a lot of women today, abortion is becoming less accessible. And that's why I think activism at the federal level also needs to be happening at the state level. And I think in some places it is. I mean, if you look at Texas,
yes,
there's some really amazing sort of grassroots organizing going on there about laws that are specific to Texas.
I'm really glad you brought up Texas because it's a great example for both of our points. It took several years for Texas courts to overturn many of those laws, especially with the requirement of the ambulatory clinic, right? These very specific requirements for a right. clinic that was going to offer an abortion. Now, that I think that, some of those laws were in place for 2 years before they made it through to the court. I also feel like women activists decide which battles they're going to fight. And there are a lot of battles to fight, but they have to choose. Yeah, tell me what your thought is on that.
Well, I mean, one of the reasons I am a fiction writer versus, say, someone who aims to be a legislator or writing policy proposals is that, you know, when I think about these questions, the first place I go is, you know, how does it feel to live in a body and a sort of life that is being affected by them, you know, at the personal level, which is not to say not looking at the systematic problems we face, but what does it mean to be an individual woman who doesn't have a lot of power, who isn't a lawmaker, who isn't sort of walking through the halls of legislation in Austin, Texas, or anywhere else, and then realizing how much her body and her mind are subject to these laws, right? So I don't have any answers about, you know, where we go from here in terms of organizing. But what I do feel strongly about and why I, you know, one of the reasons I wrote Red Clocks was that if we can explore and investigate and look really rigorously at the lived experience of these laws, then, you know, that's necessary to understand why some of them need to change or why we need to resist, for instance, an overturning of Roe v. Wade, precisely because of how, not the abstract kind of debate around it, but how it's going to affect us as people living in the world.
This is a really good point, because I don't want to give listeners the impression that this is just a one-track political novel, which would be fine too, but that's not what Red Clocks is. I mean, I saw this as a novel that really asks what it's like to have to make a deeply anguished decision, you know, in a landscape, right, where outside laws are affecting the biology of your own body.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. And the fact that there are a lot of different ways that we all, you know, that human beings make decisions. And, you know, in this novel, there's four main characters in the present day, as well as a fifth character who lived in the 19th century. And, you know, I was really interested in a sort of contradictory and diffuse sort of multifaceted view of experience rather than just following one woman, for instance, then that would have been a different kind of book. But I think that one of the great powers of fiction is that it can ask questions that aren't easy to answer. And so, for instance, one of the main characters is a 15-year-old who is pregnant and doesn't want to stay pregnant. And her parents are passionately anti-abortion, in part because they adopted her, and she, as an adopted person, is dealing with her own desire to be free of this pregnancy, as well as her understanding of how much her parents love her and how much she loves them, and that's the kind of choice that it's not easy to make, and that's why it's a choice. That's why it's a decision rather than just a knee-jerk reaction.
This student who is pregnant is intertwined, her life is intertwined with the life of a teacher whom you call the biographer, who desperately wants a child and comes to discover about herself that she doesn't want her student to have the abortion, even though I think this teacher would call herself pro-choice, right? She comes to this intersection where her own interests, right, are at odds with her political views and, by the way, what's best for the life of her student.
Right. Right. And that's, again, that question of which sort of paths are easy to decide to take and which are really difficult. the what she, the biographer, comes up against is that, you know, her own ego, her own self really wants this thing. And but in order to get it, she would have to betray her longstanding political principles. She's a feminist. She's pro-choice. And not only that, I mean, she is a mentor to this girl. You know, she cares about her a lot. And so I think, again, one of the things that we can do in fiction is sort of set up our characters to have their own desires meet a variety of impediments. And sometimes the impediment is internal, right? Mm. Sometimes that struggle is within, even though it's in the context of a political landscape.
Can I ask how well you understood that from the, do you find your way to that? This is so, I don't know. I guess this is such a sophisticated way to intertwine these lives, and I marveled at how effortless it felt in reading it.
Thank you. It was not. It definitely wasn't effortless.
I mean, I did, that's why I thought twice about using that word. But I think you know what I mean by that.
Yeah. No. I'm delighted that it had that effect on you. I mean, I think I'm not only a fairly slow writer, but I do spend a lot of time on the assembling of a narrative like this. And I mean, I started writing this book in 2010 and didn't finish revising it until last year, 2017. And one of the big things that I had to really get my head around is how these strands of these character strands would interact and intertwine. And it was one of the pleasures of writing the book, but it also involved a lot of, you know, printing out everything and putting pages on the floor and shuffling them around and kicking the pages when I was really frustrated.
I guess I sense such a confidence in this, but now it makes sense when you had a lot of time to really consider how these lives were going to intertwine. And then I can imagine you maybe going down a path with a couple of those characters and pulling back and having to wrestle with the puzzle of it.
Yeah, no, completely. And also, one of the cool things about writing is the fact that, you know, I don't know. There's so much I don't know or I'm not conscious of when I'm starting. And so part of the process is to look at what I've, you know, unwittingly given myself to work with. And, you know, you mentioned earlier the pink wall, and that's an example of something in the book that really developed over the course of time. You know, in the first draft of Red Clocks, I did have this notion that Canada would have a treaty with the U.S. that refused to let people seeking abortions or advanced fertility treatments over the border. But it wasn't until Trump was elected and, you know, his constant talk about build the wall. And, you know, he was talking about the Southern Wall so much that just sparked this idea in me. Okay, it's going to be called the wall in the north too, but it's going to be called the pink wall. And so, you know, that definitely didn't come at first, but that required some time.
We've introduced the biographer, and her name is Ro in the book. Would you read an excerpt from kind of as we're getting to know her, from how she's living in this new world?
Sure. This is from early in the book. She was just quietly teaching history when it happened. Woke up one morning to a president-elect she hadn't voted for. This man thought women who miscarried should pay for funerals for the fetal tissue, and thought a lab technician who accidentally dropped an embryo during in vitro transfer was guilty of manslaughter. She had heard there was glee on the lawns of her father's Orlando retirement village, marching in the streets of Portland. In Newville, on the coast, brackish calm. Short of sex with some man she wouldn't otherwise want to have sex with, Ovutran and lube-glopped vaginal wands and Dr. Kalbfleisch's golden fingers, that's the only biological route left. Intrauterine insemination, at her age, not much better than a turkey baster. She was placed on the adoption waitlist 3 years ago. In her parent profile, she earnestly and meticulously described her job, her apartment, her favorite books, her parents, her brother, drug addiction omitted, and the fierce beauty of Newville. She uploaded a photograph that made her look friendly but responsible, fun-loving but stable, easygoing but middle class. The coral pink cardigan she bought to wear in this photo, she later threw into the clothing donation bin outside the church.
You're listening to Lainey Zumas reading from her new novel, Red Clocks. She's a creative writing teacher at Portland State University. It occurred to me in thinking about the way you interact with young men and women through your teaching that you've absorbed some of their ideas and attitudes, I guess, about reproduction. And I wondered if that influenced the way you thought about it. And in fact, I ask you this, Lainey, I don't know how old you are. Can I guess that
I'm 45.
Okay, 45. Yeah. I was going to guess you were in your 30s. Okay, so it's a different. You're in a different generation and a different way of thinking probably about reproduction. I find that when I talk with younger women. What comes out of
that?
Yeah,
I mean, I love kind of talking to my students about political questions and hearing how they're coming at them and also really trying to bear witness to and support the fact that a lot of them, you know, especially at a place like Portland State where you have a lot of first-generation college students, you have a lot of people who are working full-time or who are vets and who don't have a lot of buffer in this world, who don't come from privilege, and seeing how they navigate questions about choice, about kind of how they envision their lives unfolding, it's really humbling for me. And I love the fact, too, that, I mean, there's a lot of different opinions represented at PSU. It's not, there's no party line about something like choice or, you know, other political questions. I also think that what I notice in my students is there's a lot that they can't take for granted about their future, whether it has to do with the economy or with Roe v. Wade or with sort of things that when I was coming up, you know, I went to college in the 90s and I just assumed that Roe v. Wade would be on the books forever and that if I had to make decisions about abortion, that option would be available to me. And so sometimes in 2018, when I look around at what younger people are dealing with, that precariousness and that sort of fear, especially, you know, if for people who are undocumented, you know, their parents are undocumented and the fact that they could wake up tomorrow and have their world shattered, that it's really serious. And so I'm grateful to have those conversations with students who I teach.
I was also thinking about your book reminded me of a conversation I had with one of the producers of the show a while back. And she, I'm trying to think, I think she was in her late 20s at this point. And her thinking about individual contraceptive choices and her thinking about what I guess we are still calling our biological clock, it was so different than the way that I, you know, when I was living through that time that I had to think about it. You know why? Because there was more technology available to her, more options. She felt even, you know, I took the pill for years. Now young women don't look at that as, well, you know, some other things override my willingness to take the pill, you know, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
I wonder if that comes out to you when you talk to young women about just even these individual options.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, especially when we think about how much, you know, each of us inherits these kind of old stories.
Exactly.
About, you know, you mentioned the biological clock and you know, that was actually one of the reasons I gave this book its title, because I wanted, you know, red clock is a phrase that one of the characters uses for the uterus. But it's also the notion that, you know, women kind of grow up from, you know, from a very young age before we even get our periods, like with these stories. Well, you know, like the notion we have to find a partner by a certain age or have a baby by a certain age. And there's this kind of fear put into a lot of us. I mean, I'm sure not all of us, but I think that I very sort of vaguely and unconsciously metabolized a lot of those old stories. And so when I was thinking about becoming a mother, that fear and that sort of sense of time running out was very present for me. And you know, I have a 5-year-old son, and he was conceived using IVF. And I'm incredibly grateful for that technology. And when I was doing research on IVF, that's actually what brought me to learn about the Personhood Amendment. And and so after my son was born, that question, it became even more poignant for me. Like, what if the technology that let my little boy come into the world, what if that were banned, you know? And so again, trying to see things through the prism of kind of personal impact and an emotion, but connecting that to larger grids of political and social connection.
I feel like you were also exploring something that's really prevalent, probably more so because of social media, is this, the moral shaming that goes on, right? Do you really think using IVF is, you know, is you're succumbing to technology? The natural way is really the primary, you know, that kind of
thing. Oh, yeah. I mean, I got really enraged by a lot of the comments I read. And when I was, you know, say, reading New York Times articles about in vitro fertilization, there were some extremely vicious anonymous comments saying, you know, yeah, if you can't have a baby the natural way, why are you trying to have a baby at all? And Mother Nature knows best. I mean, Mother Nature was literally referenced a lot as some sort of expert on this question. And, you know, and I just, it made me angry. It made me sad. And it made me just think, like, where do we get these ideas about, you know, because it's not just about around reproduction. I mean, there's so much in the world that, you know, people say, well, that's not natural.
Right.
You know, you shouldn't do that because, you know, nature didn't design you that way.
I appreciate the way I think this was in your mind, in the writing, with one of the characters named Susan, who's referred to as the wife.
Yeah.
Now she's struggling with this idea that motherhood is not the pinnacle of her whole reason for being. She likes being a mother, but she's also pretty honest about the fact that this is hard. And I pulled a couple of sentences out of this section from Susan. She says, before having kids, she envisioned motherhood as a jubilant merging. She never thought she would long to spend time away from them. It is hideous to admit that she can't bear the merging 24/7. Why are we a culture that really doesn't allow women to talk about the fact that this is hard and not fun, and sometimes you grit your teeth and just get through it for a few years?
Totally. Yeah. And no, that your question is that is the question we need to be asking. Why would anyone think it was hideous to admit that she doesn't want to spend 24 hours a day with a 3-year-old and a 6-year-old? I mean, I think just some of the mythologies and kind of romanticizing of the mother role in the U.S. I mean, I grew up here, so that's what I can speak to. And I know that in other parts of the world, this question would play out differently. But I think there is so much kind of guilt and shame that a lot of us feel, not just women. I mean, some of my male friends who are parents and who they're also trying to negotiate, you know, what it means to be a father and also have their own sort of intellectual and creative life. And the questions are hard. And I think that the more people, we all feel that there's different answers to, you know, how to be a parent, how to be a good parent.
Lainey Zumas is here, and we're having a conversation about her new novel, Red Clocks. I often think about, I think it's Rebecca Traister's book, All the Single Ladies, and mm-hmm. how many unattached, I guess I should say, women there are in this country. And yet, I think you're tapping this thing that still feels weird to us today. So you choose to live a life that doesn't have a partner, that doesn't have a husband in it. We still kind of marvel that a woman can be happy in that circumstance.
Yes. And we marvel, and we also, I think, kind of keep repeating certain kinds of narratives that in a more passive but no less powerful way send that message. And what I'm thinking about, you know, again, as a storyteller, as a fiction writer, how many movies, TV shows, books we consume where a character's singleness is a narrative problem to be solved. It's a plot problem.
That's right.
And you know, we don't even have to go all the way back to the 19th century where, you know, marriage or death was the sort of, those were the two outcomes usually for female characters in, you know, British and American literature. But even today, there's that question of, you know, if we look at advertising, if we look at, you know, the headlines of, you know, articles, there's that question, are you going to be happy? You know, are you going to be happy if this doesn't happen? Are you going to be happy if you don't use the face cream that will prevent your wrinkles? Are you going to be happy if you don't find a man? Yeah, that's still everywhere. And in my own life, one of the places I encountered that was, you know, over 10 years ago. So before I met my partner, I was pursuing single motherhood. I had decided I wanted to have a kid, and I was buying sperm on the internet and doing intrauterine inseminations. And a lot of the experience of the biographer character in my book is based on my own experiences as a solo woman who was undergoing these procedures. And many people in my life, including my therapist at the time, you know, questioned why I was doing this and whether, you know, did I not believe that I was going to find a partner? Did I not believe I was deserving of one? And even when I said, actually, I'm okay right now and I'm trying to do this other thing, you know, my therapist didn't believe me.
Wow.
And he kept pushing on that, you know. And so that's where my own biography really intersects with the biography of the biographer. There's a scene in Red Clocks where her therapist tells her she's deluding herself if she, you know, and that she, in saying she doesn't need or want a romantic partner.
It's super interesting. So in your own life, it couldn't, people had a hard time understanding that you could pursue this path and be open to the possibility that someday you would meet your partner and have a child that way too. Why mm-hmm. why were they exclusive?
You know, one of the ways that people's concern was articulated to me, I don't know what they were thinking in their own minds, but so many people said to me, you know, it's really hard to have a kid. You know, you should... It's so much easier with a partner. And I was not entering into pursuing single motherhood thinking it was going to be a breeze, believe me. But what was interesting to me is how often people would say, well, you know what? It's so much easier with a partner. You know, why don't you wait until you're in a relationship? And it's that kind of logic that I think gets back to your earlier question about soloness and sort of being unattached. Sometimes it's not any kind of moralizing or browbeating. It's a subtler thing of, yeah, but it's easier the other way.
Yeah. And it's right. It just looks right and feels right. Yeah. Isn't that what it is too? This conforms with the way we think this should go.
Yes, it does. And it's the path of least resistance. You know, why are you making things hard for yourself? And there's so many ways in which, you know, there's a book I read last year that I continue to go back to, and I absolutely love, called Living a Feminist Life. by a British scholar named Sarah Ahmed. And she writes a lot in this book about doing something that's different or troublesome or, you know, calling attention to a problem. And the person who does that becomes the problem herself, right? So it's that question of, why are you doing it this way? Isn't it? Wouldn't it be just so much easier and less strange if you did it the other way? You know, then the person who's kind of going about her business is becomes a problem, and
for everybody else, whether whether you know you have to worry about that or not, they're a problem because they exist and they're going on their way like this.
Or I think about, you know, when I was little, I come, you know, my mother's side of the family, it's a big Southern family. They tell stories a lot. They kind of sit around talking. And, you know, I remember overhearing the adults be like, well, poor blah, 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 you know, she's alone. Poor blah, blah, blah. She didn't end up getting married. And what does that do to any kid growing up thinking, oh, the object of pity is the person who didn't get married?
I often think that the most interesting relatives in the family are the people that, you know, didn't get married when often lived eccentric lives. Looking back, right, that seems adventurous. I guess in the moment, it seems scary to everybody else in the family.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, isn't the most, if you had a polar explorer in your family, as interested as you are in this idea, wouldn't they seem like the most, whether they married or had kids or anything, wouldn't they seem
totally
like the, yeah.
Yeah, it'd be irrelevant. It would be, well, what was she, you know, eating when she was trapped on an iceberg when the ship was surrounded in ice and
right.
they had to, you know, yeah.
What's your interest, by the way? I mean, we're the land of the amazing Anne Bancroft here in Minnesota. So I get your interest in polar exploration, but I'd like to hear it from you. What intrigues you about it?
You know, it's a longstanding obsession of mine. And I'm also a person who I love being in the cold and the ice and the snow. And as it happens, I used to live in Minnesota and
for a few years. Did you go to McAllister? Did somebody tell me that?
No, I didn't. My best friend from high school went to McAllister and she loved it. No, I lived in Minnesota for a few years, sort of the end of the 90s, beginning of the aughts. And I love the Twin Cities so much. And I'm actually going back there in June to read at this great bookstore called Moon Palace. Do you know that place?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. Cool. But, you know, I adored the winters there, you know, and people be like, how many live in Minnesota? It's you know, 50 degrees below zero. I'm like, unfortunately, it wasn't that cold today, you know, because I really, you know, just loved it. And here in Portland, it snows maybe once or twice a year and it's kind of disappointing. But I think that aside from simply, you know, loving stories of maritime disaster and Arctic exploration, I think that there's something about polar exploration, particularly before, you know, iron reinforced boats and icebreakers on boats, and at a time when truly you were risking your life and limb to go on one of these expeditions, the idea that someone could put themselves in absolute peril and sort of be in a space where there was no help, right? That you were really subject to the elements, but also it seemed sublime to me. You know, it seemed like being able to touch a kind of sphere of experience that most of us never get to access. And so when I was imagining my biographer character being obsessed with another, you know, a historical figure who she wanted to write about, it made a lot of sense to me to have that be a female polar explorer, someone who loved ice and who had taught herself hydrology and was an expert on pack ice and sea ice and who wanted to do this thing that most of the planet will never experience. And that was fascinating to me.
Lainey, thank you. This is really fun. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you, Carrie. Great to talk to you.
Lainey Zumas's book is called Red Clocks.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. to add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.